University in Waco, Texas. Specializes in applied computational intelligence, biomimetic computing, and image intelligence. Just to give you a little bit of some of his background, he was awarded the Outstanding Branch Counselor Award by the IEEE, that's the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and was presented with the IEEE Centennial Medal. He was also named a Distinguished Young Alumnus of Rose Holman Institute of Technology, and is an inductee into the Texas Tech Electrical Engineering Academy. In 2000, he was awarded the Gold Jubilee Award by the IEEE Circuits and Systems Society, and he's a fellow of both the IEEE and the Optical Society of America. Before he was went to Baylor, he was a professor at the University of Washington for 26 years.
That's right.
So we're delighted to have Professor Marks here to speak to us about some of the impact that Christian faith has had on science and mathematics over history. So Professor Marks, would you like to come?
Thank you.
Talk to us. Thank you very much. Let's give him a big hand also.
Thank you, Bob. Yes, I am on. Thank you. Delighted to be here. I have a class this quarter at Baylor. I was mentioning to some of the audience where I have one student in the class. So he comes to my office and I lecture him. And I told this to my son. He said, "Dad, what are you going to do if during your lecture he falls asleep?" And I said, "Gee, I don't know. So don't fall asleep." Okay. What I wanted to talk about was the what does calculus have to do with Christianity? Let me tell you the motivation for the talk. And there's the abstract. It actually came with one of my colleagues at Baylor University, wherein there is an ongoing debate on the role of Christian in academia. And there's been a disconnect in historicity insofar as the role of faith and academics and intellectualism. There is a current urban myth that one cannot pursue a scientific career and simultaneously be a person of faith. And that's totally incorrect, both historically and in accordance to things which are going on today. So this question, which he asked, is published in a newspaper. Where was it? The Austin American Statesman. This question, which was meant to be a rhetorical question with an obvious answer, does not have an obvious answer. In fact, that the answer that he gave was a little bit, was totally different than he expected. Here are some stronger quotes along the same line. George Smith, the famous atheist philosopher, says Christian theism must be rejected by any person with even a shred of respect for reason. Again, a total disconnect between the ability to pursue anything intellectual and be a person of faith. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, says biblical miracles are effective with an audience of unsophisticates and children. And then the great American philosopher Archie Bunker said faith is when you believe something no one in their right mind believes. So there we have just a smorgasbord of some of the urban myth which currently clouds the ability of, which currently is contributing to this idea of the separation between intellectualism and even being of faith. So let's consider then, with that as a background, what is it in the academy here at San Jose State University, at Baylor University, my old place, University of Washington? Why do these institutions exist? What are the professors there doing research and such attempting to pursue? If you go to them and you were to ask them, what are you pursuing? Chances are many of them would say something like, I am seeking truth. I am attempting to find out truth. And the philosophers don't even seek truth. They rather spend all their time figuring out what the definition of truth is before they can seek it. So this is what the people in the academy indeed would say. This is the facade which surrounds many of these institutions. The reality is that there's another dimension which is pursued by people in academia, and that is seeking fame and power. I think it was Henry Kissinger that said, the politics of the universities are so intense because there's so very little at stake. Here's an email that I actually got from a colleague of mine. And he said, I would like you to nominate me for an award. We like to think that all of these accolades that you get, some of them were mentioned by Buff in my introduction, that there are some great men and women of vision who look along the sea of great accomplishments and say, you are worthy, you are worthy, you are worthy. It isn't that way in reality. A lot of it is people actually going out, scratching the awards and then attempting to get nominated and given these awards. So this guy said, Bob, I'm attaching a file that gives a short list of my contributions to optical science. I would very much like if you nominated me for this award because I deserve this award. And then he tells me who to write, what to say, and gives an attachment of the dictates. Here's another one. I'm actually here in San Jose. Another reason is the IEEE Circuits and Systems Society Executive Committee that runs that society. And a few years ago in that society, they had an awards committee, and they said, we should award the Jubilee Medal. That was one, actually, that Buff mentioned. So the awards committee got together, and they says, yeah, you know, we should award these. We should keep the number of awards to a small level. And, you know, everybody on this committee is so great. We should give ourselves the awards, too. And, in fact, they did that. And it was a great controversy. It says, here was an email I got. I have never known an awards committee where the members grant each other awards and medals. I don't contest the committee members are not deserving of an award, but the mere fact of serving on the selection of a committee should exclude one from receiving the awards. So, indeed, we have evidence here that, indeed, there are some people in academia and in professional societies that are seeking fame. I love this. U.S. Knows More report, they did a poll. This shows the modesty of the academician. It said that 94% of the respondents, the professors, thought they were better at their job than their average colleague. I showed this to John Walkup. He says, kind of like Garrison Keillor on the Prairie Home Companion, where all the children are above average. Well, professors all think that they're above average. So. Now, there's another dimension. We've talked about what motivates research at the academy. Seeking truth, seeking fame, power, political power, whatever. There's actually a historical reason and a reason that exists now for pursuing excellence in academia, and that is actually seeking God. And let me show you some of the aspects behind this claim, this premise, if you will. Especially in the areas of science and math. I'm an engineer, so much of the perspective of my talk that I'm giving you here is through the eyes of an engineer, scientist, mathematician, a nerd, if you will. In science and math, researchers see the beauty of creation. We're surrounded by it all the time. Some believe that because of the evidence of this creation, that there must be a creator of this beauty. So let me give you a couple of premises. My premise number one, which I'm going to spend a little bit of time defending, is that some scientists, engineers, and mathematicians embrace a strong belief in God. This is both historical and current, and I will cite you literature and references to defend this. Motivation for research in certain cases stems in part from their curiosity of discovering God's creation and the awe and remarkable beauty of the relationships they uncover. Louis Pasteur kind of summed this up very nicely in six words. It says, science brings man closer to God. Louis Pasteur also said, the more I study nature, the more I stand amazed at the work of the Creator, and to his tiniest creatures, God has placed extraordinary properties. Louis Pasteur looked through a microscope, saw those little amoebas and bugs, and he saw through the beauty of that creation the handiwork of a creator. George Washington Carver said, God is going to reveal to us things he never revealed before if we put our hands in his. Now, George Washington Carver actually named his laboratory, I love this, God's Little Workshop, which I don't think would be politically correct to do today in a secular university. Hitting the wrong button. Now, here's an interesting list, and we're actually going to go through this. We've hit two people, Louis Pasteur and George Washington Carver. We're going to hit a number of other people. This is Biography's list, which they made at the change of the millennium, of the top 100 persons of the millennium in terms of importance, in terms of the impact of their work on people. Number two in this is Isaac Newton, who, of course, is the discoverer of classic physics and co-inventor of the calculus. Also included is Louis Pasteur, who we have heard from. Michael Faraday, some of you might not know, some of you not in engineering might not know Michael Faraday. He is actually the father of electronics, the father of electrical engineering. Michael Faraday is listed as number 61. Also included, not on the list, is Blaise Pascal. Those of you in computer science have maybe heard of the programming language Pascal, or Pascal's triangle. And also James Clerk Maxwell, the discoverer of Maxwell's equations, and Thomas Bayes, the father of statistical inference. I want to visit a few of these people in history, look at what they did, kind of review it, especially if you're not from an engineering background, and then look at why they did it. Many times in engineering and other fields, we look at what people did. We have Newton's laws, we have Bayesian inference, we know what they did, but we don't know who the people were and what motivated them to do the things that they did. I want to, in support of my premise, go through a few of these. Let's first of all look at Isaac Newton. Of course, Newton was the inventor, the discoverer, if you will, of Newtonian physics. It is the basic physics which even today is taught in high schools and college campuses. If you go into technology, it's required that you understand Newtonian physics. Now, since then, in the 20th century, there have been wings added on to this fundamental foundation for the very small quantum theory and the very large string theory. I'm sorry, the very large relativity. There is work now at even attempting to combine those. But the basic foundation of all physics was laid by Newton and his mind. He has a number of things which he has contributed. One is Newtonian physics. He is the inventor of the calculus. He invented it simultaneously with Leibniz, and they both did it independently about the same time. He's the discoverer of the law of universal gravitation. He's the father of optics. He invented the reflecting telescope. He showed that white light spread out into different components. And Newton was actually kind of a nerd. If you read his biography, he was interested in color, and one of the things he used to do was go outside and look at the sun and then close his eyes because he saw, made him see lots of colors. And he went blind for a while because of doing that. But apparently it helped him figure out what colors were. He's so famous, he's made postage stamps. Here we see France, the Soviet Union, and Germany. The Newton, the MKS unit of force is named after him, Newton's rings. In optimization, we have Newton-Raphson method, Newtonian physics. Apple came out with a computer a long time ago called Apple's Newton, and it was in reference to Newton. And then there's the Newtonian constant of gravitation. The guy did a lot of work. Here is what Newton felt about his work. Here's a quote from Newton in terms of astronomy. The beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. Again, the premise of scientists looking at some of the things that they see in science and seeing in that the handiwork of a creator. Certainly, Newton did that. Pasteur looked through a microscope, saw little amoebas, saw God. Newton looked through a telescope, saw planets, and saw the creation of a God. The book Optics, which is still in print today, you can go and buy it on Amazon.com, has an interesting passage in the introduction where Newton said, God in the beginning formed matter and solid, massy, hard, impenetrable, movable particles of such sizes and figures and with other such properties in such proportion to space as most conduce to the end for which he formed them. Now, you know what he was doing here? He was actually looking at the Bible, and he was looking at a verse in Bible and actually paraphrasing it in the introduction to his text. In Revelations it said, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created. Newton was actually taking this passage and actually put it into the introduction of his text. Newton did not keep his opinions to himself on atheism. He said, atheism is so senseless and odious to mankind that it never had many professors. By the way, professors, isn't that a curious word? I have these all documented, And if you email me, I can give you the website if you'd like to follow up on any of the documentation and the resources that I'm giving for the source of these quotations. Another one, Michael Faraday. Michael Faraday, the father of electrical and electronic engineering. Those of us in the area of electronics and electromagnetics are familiar with Faraday's law. He discovered electromagnetic induction generators, motors, and transformers. The foundation of most motors today, including the little CD drives you have in your computers to the big ones, are based on Faraday's initial invention. He's the inventor of the Faraday effect, and some people even call him the father of biochemistry because he was actually the first to discover a benzene, in this case, which was a biological chemical. He built the first practical electric motors. And here are some words that when you invent new stuff, you get to name things. And Faraday named a bunch of stuff, and we use these words today. He coined the word electrode. He coined the word anode, cathode. And the entire word electronic was a term which was coined by Faraday. If you study physics or engineering, you know that the farad, named after Faraday, is the unit of capacitance. He even has a universal constant named after him, which is Faraday's constant. Now, what motivated Faraday? Oh, before we do that, a testimony to his fame. Albert Einstein was an enormous, devoted admirer of Faraday. While still in Berlin, Einstein kept a large portrait of Faraday in his study. Afterwards, when he fled Europe, to avoid the Nazis, Einstein again displayed a large portrait of Faraday, this time at his Princeton study. Einstein, who did not believe in God, nevertheless really appreciated the intellectual contributions that Faraday had given. Faraday's biographer writes, "Faraday's standard of duty was supernatural. It was formed entirely on what he held to be the revolution of the will of God in the written word, and throughout all of his life, his face led him to act to the very letter of it." We talked about before about these people giving themselves awards and about people sending email to get awards. We have very strong evidence that Faraday was not motivated by this idea of fame. He was actually, because of his monumental discoveries, offered the presidency of the Royal Society of England, which is an enormously prestigious chair, and he said, "No, I'm really not interested in this. I must remain just plain Michael Faraday to the very, very last." Another person which you might have heard of, Bayes' theorem. Anybody heard of Bayes' law? Okay, Bayes' theorem. If you haven't heard of Bayes' law, do you have spam filters? Spam filters, most all spam filters, actually use Bayesian inference to pick out the spam that comes to your email. So the foundation of Bayes and Bayesian inference is something that is used today and indeed spawned an entire field. So Bayesian inference is making classifications using an historical database, and it is one of the most visible applications of it today is it's the foundation of most email spam filters. Well, it turns out Thomas Bayes was a pastor, and he spent all of his life as a pastor of a Presbyterian church in England, a little south of London. And he never published anything in his entire life, even though he's very famous. His biography says that he really didn't consider what he was doing as important as his pastoral duties. So he would do this more as a hobby and never published anything. In fact, none of his publications came until his death. After his death, one of his friends discovered some of his papers and actually had them published. So, indeed, here was a person who not only had a consistency between their faith and their scientific development, but he was a fellow who actually dedicated his life to being a pastor. James Clerk Maxwell. Wow, what a guy. What this guy did was really incredible. In the 19th century, he took a lot of interesting things and put them all together, a lot of interesting physical laws, put them together into something which today is called Maxwell's equations. We have people in our department, my old department, the University of Washington, who spend their entire lives studying Maxwell's equations, because in these four equations are included most of the things which drive electromagnetics. In fact, all things that drive electromagnetics. Our IEEE student branch sells t-shirts which said, "And God said," they list Maxwell's equations, "and there was light." Because indeed, from Maxwell's equations, you can derive things such as the speed of light, the mechanics is a poor word, but the actual physics by which light propagates, all of them are locked into these four beautiful equations. The accolades about Maxwell's equations are really almost funny to those who haven't experienced them. I had a book as an undergraduate by Holliday and Resnick, and they said Maxwell's equations can be appreciated by those who understand them on an aesthetic level. So they put it really up there on a platform, said this is something that you should put up there as art and look at it. Another electromagnetic book said, "To anyone who is motivated by anything beyond the most narrowly practical, it is worthwhile to understand Maxwell's equations simply for the good of his soul." Ludwig Boltzmann, a Nobel laureate, said, "Was it a God who wrote these equations?" And Einstein said, "The formulation of Maxwell's equations is the most important event since Newton's time." It really was. There's an enormous beauty in Maxwell's equations. He also did some other wonderful things. Maxwell's biographer writes, "As with Faraday, Maxwell's profound investigations into nature were concomitant to deep religious reverence for nature's cause." Again, he looked at nature and he saw God, the creation of God. Maxwell is quoted as saying, "I believe that man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever." Near his death, he said, "The only desire which I can have is, like David, to serve my own generation by the will of God and then fall asleep." A very deeply religious man was Maxwell. And then one of my heroes. The more I read about Blaise Pascal, the closer friend he becomes, and the more I'm appreciative of this great man. Pascal is taught to those in mechanical engineering, in electrical engineering, and in computer engineering. And also, if you go to a seminary, you will study Pascal's theological writings. The guy was just all over the board with things. Let's review what he did technically. Pascal is a high-level programming language. He had nothing to do with Pascal. It was named in his honor, and it was written in 74 and is still in use today. Pascal's law is the foundation of hydraulics. And it says the pressure in a fluid is transmitted equally to all distances and all directions. The Pascal is the MKS unit for pressure. And, of course, we're familiar with Pascal's triangle, things that he did in the area of mathematics. Pascal was also the one to invent the first computer back in 1642. He invented a mechanical version of a calculator, and he began to create a machine that would be similar to an everyday calculator, to today's calculator, to help his father with accounting a job. He finished it in 1645. He presented it to the Queen of Sweden, who gave him the exclusive monopoly over it. And I'm not sure about the success of his business in marketing it, but I think historically the fact that he was the creator, inventor of the first computer is kind of interesting. And this is the reason that in computer science they name things after Pascal, is because of the great work he did in that area. He's a great mathematician. Here's Pascal's mystical hexagram. I won't go over this, but it's really interesting if you have a chance to look at it. Pascal's triangle, which most people in high school are introduced to. From this triangle, you could do things, for example, such as figure out in a deck of 52 cards, how many poker hands are there? You just go to the 52nd row of this Pascal's triangle and go over five cards, and whatever number is there is the number of poker hands that exist. So these are referred to as binomial coefficients and are used in the area of combinatorics quite a bit. Also, getting back to fame, did fame motivate Pascal? Pascal actually wrote that fame really was something you had to be careful about. Pascal wrote, "Fame is so sweet that we love anything we connect with it, even death." So it was something that he was aware of, and he recognized again the danger of doing this, unlike those previous examples that we talked about today of people who are pursuing this fame. I love Pascal, too, because he also wrote a lot of philosophical things, and he said, why do we watch a lot of TV? Why do we spend our time watching Monday night footballs? Why do we spend our time diverting ourselves and diverting our attention from people? He said, the reason that we do this is because there are some deep thoughts that we want to stay away from. We do not like to think why we're here, what's going to happen to us when we die, what our purpose is here. Why are we just little? Are we little specks in this enormous universe without any significance? And his claim was that this led persons to a great deal of introspection, and without a theological foundation for some of these questions, that it left one feeling enormously empty. In fact, you can see the final line. He says, "You have gloom, depression, chagrin, resentment, and despair." And this was actually, anybody know Nirvana? I'm a student of Nirvana. I've listened to the poetry. They're very tragic people, but there's a really very sad beauty in the poetry of the lyrics. Their most popular song was actually a translation of Pascal, where in Smells Like Teen Spirit, Kurt Cobain sings, "With the lights out, it's less dangerous. Here we are now, entertain us, distract us, have us think about things that really are not important." And the end of the song goes, "The denial, the denial, the denial, the denial, the denial." I don't want to, in this presentation, give you the feeling that all of the great men and women in history that made contributions in science and mathematics believed in God. Like today, there were those who were detractors. One was Laplace. Many of you in engineering and science will recognize the name of Laplace. He's named after the Laplace transform. He has noise named after him, Laplace noise. And he was also historically very important in establishing the metric system. Now, Laplace was an atheist and did not believe in God. He worked under Napoleon, and he presented Napoleon with a treatise on celestial mechanics, and Napoleon leaf through it, and he says, "Well, where is God in your writings?" You saw that Newton felt it was important to put God in his writings. Laplace didn't. And he replied to Napoleon, "Sir, I had no need of that hypothesis. I have no need of God in doing what I do." So again, not all of these people in history were believers in God, and I don't want to I want to make sure that that's clear, and I'm not making that supposition. I think that, like today, there are those who do see God in the creation and those that don't. Okay, let's kind of sum up. Researchers see the beauty of the creation. Some go the additional step, and they ask, who created this beauty? It's much like there's a beautiful painting. You know, this painting could not have occurred by accident. So if there is this beautiful painting, who is it that created this painting? There is a premise that these scientists and I would propose. There is no lack of proof of God through his work, predisposed by a blind faith worldview and numbed by the continual presence of miracles. There is only an unwillingness to accept the evidence. There's actually, St. Paul in the Bible actually said this very clearly. He says, ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So therefore, as these scientists have seen God in the work, St. Paul says that this has been true even when I'm writing this a couple thousand years ago. So here's premise number two. Premise number one was that many scientists, not all scientists, but many scientists, look at the beauty that they're uncovering, and people like Newton and Maxwell and Pascal actually believe that the world was created by a very orderly God, and that because it was created by an orderly God, that there was a beauty and an order in the creation that he made, and spent their time looking into this beauty and creation. This motivated their work and motivated their uncovering of these beautiful laws. If you ever think about it in the law of physics, you can take all of the major laws of physics, Schrodinger equation, Maxwell's equation, the quantum mechanical equations, and list them all on one piece of paper, and all of those equations describe the creation of physics. It's really remarkable about the simplicity and the beauty of it. Maxwell's equations would be including there. So here's premise number two, the knowing of God, the creator of the universe, looking at this creator, looking at the creation, There is the second dimension, in that if this creation exists, that there must have been a creator associated with it. I want to find out who it is. Many of these scientists say that they embrace Christianity as the source of where this creation comes from. Now, you use the word Christianity quite a bit, and there's numerous different definitions of it. I want to be very clear in what I mean by a definition. Christianity means the knowing of God, the creator of the universe personally, belief in God supremely, and saving grace made possible through the sacrifice of his son, Jesus Christ. Christianity, of course, is an expansion of the word Christ. One of the questions that might be asked, which is commonly asked, is, well, all this was in the past. Everybody that you've said, this is in the 19th century, 18th century, is it true today? There was a recent study done by the MIT historian Alan Lightman, who actually looked at the faith of scientists and mathematicians today. And he said, indeed, contrary to popular myth, and again I introduced this idea that being of faith and being a person of intellect were mutually exclusive, was indeed an urban myth. Indeed, contrary to popular myth, scientists appear to have the same range of attitudes about religious matters as does the general public. This is today. So indeed, according to Lightman's work, that this indeed exists today. Here are some Christian professors. This is John Walkup. John's sitting here. Bill Zoller, he's a chemistry professor where I live. William Bradley. I could just go on and on, but the number of people who are Christians and professors are all over the place. And you ready for the last one? Buff Furman here. So, indeed, the statistics are something which are irrefutable, that there are people of faith that are pursuing research and intellectual pursuits. Let's look at some of the comments that were made by these great scientists before they were generally concerning God. Let's look what they said concerning their belief, not in the creation, but the Creator. Isaac Newton said, "There is one God, the Father ever living, omnipresent, omniscient, almighty, the maker of heaven and earth, and one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ." Now, I'm not here to give a sermon or anything. I'm just giving you some historical facts to hopefully debunk the myth about the separation between intellectualism and being of faith. Newton said, "We account the scriptures of God to be the most sublime philosophy. I find more sure marks of authenticity in the Bible than in any profane history whatsoever. Worshipping God and the Lamb," and by this he meant Jesus Christ, "in the temple God for his benefaction in creating all things, and the Lamb for his benefaction in redeeming us with his blood." Isaac Newton was undoubtedly, by the definition that I gave, a Christian and saw the Creator in the tenets of Christianity. Michael Faraday was also embraced Christianity as the foundation of some of the works that he uncovered. He said, "Though the thought of death brings the thought of judgment, it also brings to the Christian thought of Jesus Christ, who died and rose again for the justification of those who believe him." One of the beautiful things, by his death time, when Faraday was on his deathbed, he had become enormously famous for his technological contributions. And he had reporters all around him. And one of the reporters asked Faraday, they said, "What's going to happen to you when you die? What are your speculations?" And Faraday remarked on his deathbed, he said, "Speculations, I know nothing about speculations." He says, "Resting on certainties," he had a certainty in his faith, "I know my Redeemer liveth, and because he lives, I shall also live." Michael Faraday said, "Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. The Christian religion is a revelation, and that revelation is the Word of God." Maxwell's biographer also writes about Maxwell's faith. Maxwell was a Presbyterian, and Maxwell's biographer says, "Clearly, from an early age, a devout Christian faith and demanding mental discipline were for Maxwell part of the same experience. The faith dimension and the intellectual pursuit dimension were part of the same thing, not anything mutually exclusive." Blaise Pascal wrote, "We know God only through Jesus Christ. Through Jesus Christ we know God. All who have pretended to know him and prove him without Jesus Christ have only had impotent proofs." Now, Pascal actually used a very interesting word here, which is proof. which is a very curious word for a mathematician to use. Pascal is also the origin of a very famous saying, which says there's a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man, which only God can fill through his son, Jesus Christ. So Pascal also embraced Christianity as a part of his belief, who was the creator of these different things that he was exploring. Pascal also did a wager. This was kind of interesting. At Pascal's time, many of the people that he were talking to were into gambling. And during Pascal's time, the Bernoullis were very popular and affluent, and a lot of people, Buffon and Buffon's Needle, and a lot of the probability theory was being generated at this time because of interest in gambling. And during Pascal's time, probability was actually the rage. In fact, Pascal has a distribution named after him, the Pascal something-something distribution in probability. So Pascal, in explaining his belief, actually came up with Pascal's wager, which was aimed at those scientists and mathematicians who were doing probability, and it was couched in the word of probability. Pascal's wager actually goes with a Venn diagram, and here was what Pascal did. He said, look, here's a Venn diagram, and here's everything that can happen. Look, there's either no God or God exists. By the way, this has no theological implications, well, it has theological implications, but it's totally from a worldly logic point of view. And he says, look, there's no God, there's a God. Okay, you either believe or you don't believe. And this was Pascal's version of his wager. He says, let's go through it. This is the universe, something, what happens. Well, suppose that you believe and there's no God, well, at least you live a good life. Now, Pascal's supposition here was that if you had a life of faith and you believed that something good was going to happen to you after you died, for example, eternal life, which Christians believe, that at least your life was good, even if you had a no God. So we might ask the question, you answer this yourself, do you think that people who are Christians are more or less generally happy about their lives, who they are, where they're going, what they're doing? He says, if there's no God, that's the situation. Now, if God exists and you believe, hey, you've got eternity with God, that's good. Okay, if you don't believe, then you have a life with limited purpose. I think this is a statement from somebody with a theological bent. If you think you're going to die and return to a pile of dust, well, that's not too exciting a reason to live. And then, of course, if you don't believe and there is a God, according to the Christian doctrine, then you spend eternity without God. So, according to Pascal and Pascal's wager, he says, look, you can either choose out of column A or column B. Which one do you choose from a totally pragmatic point of view? Do you want to choose out of column A, where you don't believe and either live a life with limited purpose or eternity without God? Or do you want to choose from column A, which at least you led a good life or you have eternity with God? This, by the way, Pascal's wager, if you're familiar with the Nash equilibrium, Beautiful Mind, you see the movie? It has a flavor of game theory in the Nash equilibrium, interestingly. Although I'm sure that Pascal wasn't thinking about that. So again, let's kind of summarize where we've been. Knowing the painting is not the same thing as knowing the painter. If you are a scientist or a researcher and you uncover these beautiful creations that you believe had a divine reason for existing, you can look at that creation, that painting, all you want, and you still won't know the painter. So the painter, in this case, is the next step that these scientists that I talked about perceived. So premise number two is that many of the scientists pursued the knowing of God, the creator of the universe, personally, and they had a belief in God supremacy and saving grace made possible through the sacrifice of his son. I'm going to skip these here, and I'm actually going to go to the end here and wrap things up. Pascal, when he died, Pascal went through something called a night of fire, and it was the night where he was convinced that he wanted to be a Christian. It was a night where he became enthralled by the Christian message and by who Christ was. And when Pascal died, they were taking off his jacket and they cut the lining and they found out there were some papers inside of his jacket. What Pascal had done is, on this night of fire, this night of his conversion to Christianity, he had written down notes as to the experience of his conversion and exactly the emotions and the steps that he went through. And it's an experience that many Christians, myself included, have gone through similar sort of things. But Pascal is really interesting because of the historicity of it. Let me share with you a few of the things that were on these notes that were discovered in his lining of his jacket, supposedly to keep him next to his heart his entire life. We know the day that he had the night of fire. It was Monday, November 23rd, 1654. And then the feeling that he had upon this conversion experience. He said, "Certitude, certitude, feeling, joy, peace, God of Jesus Christ, thy God and my God, forgetfulness of the world and of everything except God." So he was totally overwhelmed by this experience of his conversion. He said, "Let me not be separated from him eternally. This is eternal life, that they might know the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent." And then the overall experience of his conversion, which was joy, 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 tears of joy. Pascal realized that he had been given enormous gifts, because some of the things he did were just, if you think about it, the father of hydraulics, the inventor of the first computer, eventually a great theologian, all of these different things. But this was his prayer concerning himself, realizing that he had been given great gifts. Pascal, in this document which he had sewed in the lining of his coat, said, "Jesus Christ, I have separated myself from him. I have fled from him, denied him, crucified him. Let me never be separated from him. We keep hold of him only by the ways taught in the gospel. Renunciation, total and sweet, total submission to Christ and to my director, eternal and joy for a day's training on earth. I will not forget thy words. Almighty God, who gave your servant Blaise Pascal a great intellect," he was thanking God for this intellect which he had given him to uncover God's work, "that he might explore the mysteries of your creation, and who kindled in his heart a love for you and a devotion to your service, mercifully give us your servants, according to our various callings, gifts of excellence in body, mind, and will, and grace to use them diligently and to your glory. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever." This again was on that sheets of paper that Pascal had sewn in the lining of his coat. When they discovered it, nobody knew about it. It was something that just he did in order to document his experience and to keep it close to his heart until clearly he died. So that concludes my presentation, and I will actually be delighted to spend some time answering any questions or elaborating on any of these points that you would like. There is a great verse in the Bible concerning people in academia, and I'll end with that. It's actually from Solomon. He said, "Of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the mind." Right? "Now all has been heard. Hear the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." Okay, that concludes my presentation. So with that, let me ask if there are any questions or any comments that anybody would like to have. Anything you want to take me to task for? Yes, ma'am.
Of the 100 biographies, do you know how many were Christian?
Well, let's go back. I think that we can identify a number of them. Everybody hear the question? In all of the people that were in the biographies, how many of those were Christians? In biographies, top listing of 100? Well, where did it go? It's up here a little bit. Here we go. Okay, let me put it up here. Can you read those? Okay. Johann Gutenberg was number one. Should have mentioned that. He's probably had the biggest impact of all the people that have lived in the last 1,000 years, according to biography. I don't know his disposition, but we do know what's the first thing he printed. Gutenberg Bible, right? So certainly there was a predisposition there. Isaac Newton, we talked about. Third one is Martin Luther. Do you think he was a Christian? Yeah, probably. Charles Darwin? Do you know, interestingly, Charles Darwin was a Christian. If you read his book, his work has been demonized as a reason for not having a necessity for a creator, which is a whole philosophical argument which we'll have on another day. But Darwin himself was a Christian. Shakespeare, I don't know. Christopher Columbus, I'm not sure. Anybody know? I don't know. Karl Marx? No. No relation either. He was an atheist. Albert Einstein was not a believer in God. His God was the universe that he was exploring, and he saw great beauty in that. Nicholas Copernicus, yes, indeed, was a Christian, even though he alienated himself from the church because of the heliocentric model that he proposed. Copernicus actually himself would, his first book, for example, he dedicated to the Pope at the time. And he thanked God for the Pope and the great discoveries that he had made, and fell directly into this scenario that we're talking about, wherein he saw a beauty of a creation and he ascribed it to God. A similar sort of story for Galileo. If you look at the interchange between Galileo and the church during the time of his excommunication, you will see a strong faith which is given by Galileo. In fact, he was the one that said, wonderfully, he says, I refuse to believe, and I'm paraphrasing, I refuse to believe that God has given me, given mankind an enormous intellect and told us not to use it. So he was actually a believer. Da Vinci, I don't know. Freud, Pasteur, we saw indeed was. I'm unsure about Edison. I don't think that Edison was. Thomas Jefferson. 16 is Adolf Hitler. What do you think? Yeah. Mahatma Gandhi was a Hindu, I think. And then we get into some other ones.